Manguza stopped and turned to face him, and Sean was taken aback when he saw his expression. Manguza's voice quivered with fury as he said, "Your assumption that I am open to a bribe is an insult to me personally, that I could tolerate, but it is also an insult to the revolution and the revolutionary heroes who died in the struggle to free this country of the imperial and colonial yoke. It is an insult to the party and our leaders, to the Marxist spirit, and ultimately to the African people as a whole." "I only suggested a lousy 10 grand, not the return of the monarchy, for the love of Allah." "You may smile your supercilious white smile, Colonel Courtney, but we know you well. We know about your South African connections and about the bunch of Matabele hooligans you have gathered about you. We know that all of them fought with you against the forces of revolutionary democracy. They are counter-revolutionaries and capitalist roaders, and you are their leader." "I shot a lioness by mistake, and one of my capitalist roaders got bitten. That's the full extent of my counter-revolutionary activities." "We are watching you, Colonel," Manguza told him ominously. "You can be certain that I will make the correct recommendation in your case, and that the insult to me and my people will not be forgotten." Manguza turned and strode back towards the clubhouse, and Sean shook his head. "So we say farewell to the beautiful Chiwewe concession," he murmured. "I really blew that one." Despite his levity, he felt a sliding sensation of disaster in the pit of his stomach. The office of Courtney Safaris was in the avenues between Government House and the golf club, and Rima was waiting for him in the outer office, its walls decorated with colour posters of wildlife and photographic enlargements of satisfied clients with their trophies. She jumped up from her desk the moment Sean came in.
"The hospital called an hour ago, Sean. They have amputated Shadrach's leg."
For long moments, Sean could neither speak nor move. Then he crossed slowly to the filing cabinet and took a glass and a half-empty bottle of Shivers from the top drawer. He sagged into the sofa and poured a 3-finger jolt of whiskey. "The ending to a perfect day," he said, and tossed back the whiskey. Rima left him sitting on the sofa. There were only 2 more drinks left in the bottle, and when they were gone, Sean went down to the Monomotapa Hotel. The hotel was full of tourists, and amongst them was a blonde Teutonic Valkyrie in full out-of-Africa costume. She caught his eye across the lounge the moment that Sean walked in, and smiled. "What the hell?" Sean said to himself. "It's cheaper than whiskey, and no hangover, either." The German Fräulein laughed delightedly at Sean's rudimentary German, and not long afterwards it transpired that she had the presidential suite on the 14th floor, all to herself. She ordered a bottle of Mumm from the room service, and they drank it in bed. In the morning, while Rima filed a flight plan for him, taking a bag of dried meat down to air traffic control, Sean returned to the hospital. They had taken Shadrach's leg off, only inches below the hip. The East German doctor showed Sean the X-ray plates. "Hopeless," he pointed out the bone fragments. "Like confetti." There was no place to sit in the crowded surgical ward, so Sean stood beside Shadrach's bed for a while, and they talked about the battles and the hunts they had shared. They did not mention the leg, and when they'd run out of reminiscences, Sean gave the ward sister $100 to look after him and went out to the airport. Rima had the flight plan for him, and the Beechcraft was refueled and loaded with everything from fresh fruit and vegetables to toilet paper for the camp. "You are a heroine, Rima," he said. And then, standing beside the aircraft, he described the meeting with Geoffrey Manguza. "It doesn't look very cheerful," he added. "You had better begin looking for another job."
"I am sorry for you, Sean," she said. "But don't worry about me. I was wondering how to break the news to you. I'm leaving for Canada on September 16th. It's all arranged. I am going to be the wife of a professor.
You be happy,
Sean ordered, and for the first time kissed her, and she blushed under her nut-brown skin, which made her prettier than ever. Sean made 3 low-level passes over the camp, and on the 3rd he saw the Toyota pull out towards the airstrip, with Job driving a Matatu standing in the back. He landed and taxied the Beechcraft into its cage of galvanized diamond mesh wire, which was designed to discourage the elephant from pulling the wings off and the lions from chewing the tires. When Job and Matatu arrived in the Toyota, they transferred the cargo to it, and then Sean told them about Shadrach's leg. They'd all fought through the bush war together and were hardened to casualties, but Sean saw the pain and grief in his eyes as Job murmured, "We'll need a new No. 2 gun-bearer. Pumula, the skinner, is a good man."
"Yes, we'll use him," Sean agreed.
For a while they stood silently, paying tribute to their maimed companion. Then, still without speaking, they climbed into the Toyota and drove back to camp. Rather than slacks, Claudia Montero wore a dress for dinner that evening, a floating silk chiffon in pure white with silver and turquoise semi-nole jewellery. Against her tanned skin and jet-black hair, the effect was stunning. However, Sean made certain not to show his admiration, and he directed all his conversation at her father. After he had told Ricardo about Shadrach and his meeting with Manguza, the evening was gloomy and cheerless. Claudia left the men at the campfire, but they didn't sit there long before Ricardo said good night and went off to his tent. Sean took a bottle of whiskey from the dining tent and went down towards the servants' village. Job's tent, and those of his 2 wives, were set apart from the others on the bank of the river, overlooking a deep pool where Hippo lay like dark rock islands in midstream. When Sean seated himself on the carved native stool across the fire from Job, one of the wives brought 2 glasses and knelt beside him while he poured a large peg for each of them. The pretty young Matabele girl with Job's infant strapped on her back took the glass to her husband, and Job saluted Sean across the flickering flames. They drank in silence, and Sean watched Job's face in the firelight as he stared out across the river. The silence was companionable and comforting, and Sean let his thoughts wander back down the years as he rolled the smoky taste of whiskey over his tongue. He remembered the day he had first met Job Bacani. It had been on a hill with only a number, Hill 31, a rocky hill, thick with strands of dense wild ebony and jesse bush where the enemy waited. Job had been on the hill for 2 days, and his eyes were wild and bloodshot. Sean had parachuted in that morning with 5 sticks of his own scouts. They fought side by side the rest of that day, and in the dusk, when the hill was cleared and those of the enemy still alive had fled down the rocky slopes and disappeared into the forest, Sean and Job had helped each other to where the helicopter waited to take them out. They had gone down the hill slowly, wearily, dragging their weapons, arms around each other's shoulders, and their blood mingling when it oozed from under the field dressings.
"Blood brothers, whether you like it or not,"
Sean had croaked, grinning at Job from under the camouflage cream and soot and dust. And a week later, when Job was released from base hospital, Sean had been waiting for him, personally, with his transfer papers.
"You've been seconded to Ballantyne's scouts, Captain."
And Job had smiled, that rare, wide smile, and said,
"Let's go, Colonel."
From his file, Sean knew that Job had been born on the Gwai River and attended the local mission school, where he had obtained a bursary to the University College of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, from where he had graduated with a first in politics, history, and social anthropology. From there, he had gone on with another bursary to Brown College in Chicago and got his master's the same year that Ian Smith declared unilateral independence. Only much later, when they tried and tested their friendship, did Sean learn how Job
had herded his father's cattle along the Gwai River, and come even as a child to know and love the wilds. Job's father was one of the grandsons of King Lobengula, son of great Mzilikazi. So Job was a direct descendant of the royal Zulu line, and this was apparent in his carriage and his features. A powerful jaw and deep forehead, the dark, intelligent eyes and domed skull beneath the thick, close-cropped curls. During his studies and his sojourn in America, Job had come to abhor the communist doctrine and all its works. So it was natural that on his return to Africa, he had enlisted in the Rhodesian African Rifles and within a year had earned his commission. After the war, when the Lancaster House Agreement had given the country over to Robert Mugabe and his people's democracy, Job had sat and passed with honours the civil service entrance exam, for government and politics was the swift high road to power and wealth. However, he was branded a sellout who had fought the war on the wrong side, the losing side, and he was a Matabili when the power was in the hands of the Shona tribe. Every door to advancement was barred against him. Angry and disillusioned, he had come back to Sean. "Damn it, Job, you're miles too good for any job I could offer you in a safari company. Tracker, skinner, gun-bearer, whatever you like, I'll take it," Job had insisted. So they had hunted together as they had fought, side by side, and within a year Sean had made him one of the directors of Courtney Safaris. They always referred to these quiet evenings, drinking whiskey around the campfire, as directors' meetings. It amused Job to adopt various roles for different circumstances. In front of safari clients, he shifted to what he called plantation nigger mode when he called Sean Bwana and Ngozi and acted out the charade of the bygone colonial era. "Don't be a prick, Job. You demean yourself," Sean protested at first. "It's what the clients expect," Job had reasoned. "We are selling them an illusion, man. They are playing Eagle Scouts and Ernest Hemingway. If they guessed I had a master's in history and politics, it would frighten the hell out of them." And reluctantly, Sean had gone along with the act. When they were alone, as they were now, Job changed into what he called his Homo sapiens mode and became the thoughtful, intelligent, educated man he truly was. As they talked, they switched easily from Sindabili to English, each of them as perfectly at ease and comfortable in each other's language as they were in each other's company. "Look, Sean, don't worry too much about losing this concession. It hasn't happened yet, and even if it does, we'll find a way around it."
"Give me some comfort. I could do with it."
"We could apply for another concession somewhere in Matabili land, where my family still has pull. Down Matetsi way, or even on the Gwai River. That's my home turf."
"No good," Sean shook his head. "After this fiasco, I'll have the mark of the beast on me."
"We'd apply in my name," Job suggested, and smiled wickedly. "I'd make you one of my directors, and you can call me Bwana."
They laughed together, the mood lightening. And when Sean left Job at his fire and walked back to the main camp in the darkness, he felt cheerful and optimistic for the first time in days. Job had the power to effect that transformation in him. As he approached his own tent, something pale moved in the moon shadow beneath the trees, and he stopped abruptly. Then he heard the tinkle of silver jewellery and realised that she must have been waiting for him.
"May I speak with you?" Claudia said softly.
"Go ahead," he invited.
Why did that Americanism, "speak with" rather than "speak to," irritate him so, he wondered.
"I'm not very good at this," she admitted, and he gave her no encouragement. "I wanted to apologize."
"You're apologizing to the wrong person. I've still got both my legs."
She flinched, and her voice trembled.
"You're without mercy, aren't you?"
Then she lifted her chin. "All right, I guess I deserve that. I've been an idiot. I thought I knew it all, but it turns out I knew very little, and in my ignorance I've done immense damage.
I know it doesn't help much, but I'm desperately sorry.